Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 537. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. Most proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on this network, please go and visit their site, evergreenpodcasts.com. Before announcing my next guest, I'd like to give a quick shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts by Top Analyst. So this week's interview is with Ashley Recanati. Ashley's a fellow French-American and now a fellow author. Living in Shanghai and working as the MD of the APAC region for a German industrial company, Ashley recently released his book, AI Battle Royale, How to Protect Your Job from Disruption in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, published by Springer. In this conversation with Ashley, we discuss the challenges faced by people working in business to have the right attitude and skills to adapt to this fast-changing world, how to future-proof yourself and stay up to date with the new technologies, and how can we help our kids get ready? We look at some of the cultural differences, especially with his perspective being based in China. And we explore some of his key concepts and recommendations in his book. The one I liked the most was Guangxi. You'll find all the show notes on minterdial.com. And please, if you have a moment, go over and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. So yeah, I don't know whether I should be Francing with you, Englishing, or certainly Chinesing. Ashley Recanati, I mean, as an Italian name as they get, who are you?
Hi, Minter. Good morning to you. It is a bit complicated. I tend to tell people now that I'm French, American, Chinese, so that they stop asking me if I'm more French or more American, though I'm not. I don't have any genetic Chinese roots, but I've been living in this country for longer than the France or the US. So I felt entitled as of recent to just present myself that way. But it is a bit, citizen of the world, you could say, which I think is something you can relate to.
Absolutely. So tell us about your background, because I would like to lead that into the writing of this book.
Right. So I have a background on a work end, we could say, in background in finance control and manufacturing and in the retail sector. So always with a keen eye on efficiency, especially when we were doing M&As, acquiring firms that were not that doing that well, and we had to turn them around. So I've always had an eye on this. And then in the past years, I've been more and more interested in future technology. This is probably also related to the birth of my first daughter. I was more into history before, and then it kind of turned into future technology. And something that came up in a lot of the readings that I had was that there was going to be a lot of havoc coming forward in the workforce because these new technologies coming up, making certain skills irrelevant, devaluing certain expertise, and not necessarily causing massive unemployment. There are some people that talk about that, but that's really probably really far down the line. But before that, there'll be other problems happening. And shifts and where value resides for people in their work. So this is something that I really found interesting. And what really shocked me was that I couldn't find any sort of guidebook that explains to workers what they could do. Most of the books that you will find out there, they spend most of the time demonstrating the problem that is going to arrive. with statistics and a lot of arguments that are really well built, but they spend very little time on the solutions. When they look at solutions, it's more going to be for educational reform or tax reform or things that the governments can do or things that business leaders can do. There's also a lot of books that talk about, how to harness big data and avoid getting disrupted by Apple and Tesla and all these companies. But there isn't much addressed to what the employees can do. And this is what I wanted to really focus on then, because I saw this big dearth, and I was really shocked to see this. So I started writing an article here, an article there, and then progressively I got to this project of writing a book. And yeah, here we are in 2023 now.
Indeed, you talk about two gaps that need to be filled. One was the efficiency tools and the way we actually work, and the second was lack of advice in how to manage effectively. And certainly, I thought that your thesis at the end of the day is that everyone needs to find their own path.
That's right. Yeah, the reason the book is titled AI Battle Royale is the idea that right now we currently have a middle class, which it depends on the countries, obviously, but let's say it's around half of the population. It used to be more than half of the population back some 50 years ago. It was around like 60% of the US. Now it's down to about half of the population, and it's still in decline. So where do these people go? Well, they're either going further down towards low paid jobs, or they're going to higher paid jobs. So this is the phenomenon that's been happening, and that should be exacerbated further with artificial intelligence and other technologies. So then the question is, which direction are you going to go? Obviously, everyone wants to go upwards, but that involves rivalry between with your peers and your colleagues. So only a certain number of people are going to be able to get those lovely jobs. So that is where I try to come in and help people to understand, okay, you're not it, it's not a rivalry against, you're not fighting against computers, you're fighting against other people to leverage computers and other tools in order to get into those better paying jobs and survive,
It reminds me of that story of hey, there's a bear coming, and both the people in the sleeping bags, and one guy's not moving. He says, "Hey, aren't you scared?" Well, no, yeah, sure I am, but I know I can outrun you.
Yeah, that's exactly the case.
So the name Battle Royale, of course, is an intriguing name. It made me feel half American, half French. In the way that it's spelt as such. What was the actual inspiration for using that term?
It's the idea that, again, it's not everyone, but not, I'm not giving advice to everyone. When you give advice saying, okay, this is what the government should do, this is advice that concerns everyone. It's to have a better society. My point of, and this is a very good thing. I don't, I'm not disparaging that. I'm just saying that it's kind of just wishful thinking, and it's not something that the majority of readers can do anything about. So I'm wish to tell the people, like, don't just lay back and wait for government to act or go to vote and things like this. Of course you should, but that's not enough. You need to see what you personally can do in the workplace. And again, and the under the hypothesis that we're there where you have 10 people working today, maybe tomorrow there will only be 6 people, maybe there will only be 3 people. How can you become one of those last standing people? This is where the term battle royale comes from.
Well, I certainly subscribe to that thesis since when I wrote my book F Future Proof. I mean, the first three chapters are dealing with really more about attitude and mindset than actually worrying about the technologies themselves. But I mean, the book is a it feels very textbook-like in terms of the thoroughness of it, the schemes. Are you trying to approach schools and universities with it as well, or is it strictly going to be like a B to C, as we say in our old marketing jingo, for folks to come across?
I think it's more B2C, and it is potentially an issue that I kind of thought of after was that I didn't want it to be too down to earth. So I it is a bit for some people it might be a bit there might be some areas that are a bit difficult. So there could be a bit of a some areas this is something I should have I believe that should be improved because I want it to be a mass market. But in some of the parts, you do have to provide proof of what you're talking about. And Springer is a serious editor, the publisher I have. So it's really math books and textbooks and things like this. So yes, it does need to be well documented. And so there was a lot of research that was put into this. It's not just because ChatGPT came out a year ago and I'm like, okay, yeah, let's write a book about this. And no, it's been a project that I've been on for about 5 years now. So yeah, but that is a good point. It might have this effect of turning some people off, but
Well, no,
on the
but
other hand, it's well researched.
well, I'm looking at it the other way and saying that it's got the potential quality to be a book that universities, business schools might wish to take on. Because as you say, in the end of the day, I mean, if you're going to business school, for example, hopefully that it's helping you to educate you on how to deal with the context and learning how to be part geek, part executive, part creative, or whatever it will be your cocktail, should be part of the training cursus. So you talk about the subtitle is How to Protect Your Job from Disruption in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So that was another piece that you educated me on because I really hadn't thought specifically around these revolutions. I kind of stuck with my first industrial revolution from the 1800s from my schoolroom in England. But of course, there's been these new technologies. And I was just wondering, because I love the way you express, hey, listen, we're only going to know if it actually is a fourth IR posthumously. But tell us how you came across, or, when you, I know, I'm sure you had the conversation with Springer about the subtitle.
Well, that's to the sub the idea of the subtitle is to be able to explain a bit more the context of what the book is about. So it's talking about these new technologies, in particular artificial intelligence, but not only artificial intelligence, and what these technologies could how they can impact the workforce and how the employees who have a job can play their cards in this context, which is evolving very rapidly. So the idea is it's not just addressing also, it's not just this stereotype where you see a lot of research only addressing workers and manufacturing. Manufacturing is not the sole sector that is concerned here. We're talking a lot about office jobs and we're talking about white collar jobs too. So it's really addressing all of these people. I mean, it's a lot easier to use an algorithm to automate tasks or simplify work than it is to automate manual labor. So manufacturing jobs, again, this is not it's less than a third of the workforce, and it's never been more than a third of the workforce, even at its height. So it's not the main jobs that are being targeted. But the idea, yes, is how do you it's how do you keep a job as long as you're possible. I make this kind of allegory with Titanic. It's how you stay on the boat as long as possible before getting in the water.
It does have this. I mean, the image you have on the front, the battle protect. There's a whole sort of battle stations component to it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. On the front we have we have an artificial intelligence eye above that is sort of looming above this battle taking place, which is an old yes, it's
For
a
anyone
battle.
who's watching us on video, you can see the cover in the image.
Right, it's Ukiyo-e by Kuniyoshi, and it's a battle that happens, which I thought was really interesting, this battle, because if you look well on the different fighters, they're actually pieces of chess, of Japanese chess, which is called shogi, and it kind of gives the idea that there's a bit of strategy in how you play, again, how you play your cards right in order to get through and navigate through these treacherous waters.
I love it. They're most interesting. So we're talking about what's it going to take? You've told us how you went from sort of let's like me, by the way, Ashley, interested in history. My first book was a history book of Second World War, and then my second book was Future Proof, talking about the future. So it feels like a very parallel existence. Not to mention the fact that Franco-American also is my title, How does one stay up to date with everything that's going on at a global level? Because you have tentacles in America, in France, China, and let's say America and China, just those two alone, they're doing quite a lot of things. So how do you, Ashley, stay up to date?
Me myself, or how does a normal worker stay up to
Well,
date?
how do you? How do you?
It's become very difficult, especially in the past year. There's just so much coming out. So I have different sources of information, including like group chats with AI enthusiasts and people who, creatives who use things like Midjourney, Stable Diffusion, things like this. And they talk on plugins and things. And there's just so much going on now. You can't really always be up to date and be testing all of the latest things. So, yeah, it's a bit challenging, but it's also a very interesting time that we're going through. So I prefer having this than not having any change, and I find it's really thrilling. When I was a kid, I was interested in history. I thought that one of the most interesting periods of recent history, where you actually had someone who was like really putting it, going all in to develop new technologies, was a very bad example. It was the Nazis. The Nazis, they just put a lot of effort into developing new technologies, and over a decade they came out, or a decade and a half, they came out with some crazy things. But it's not really something that you want to have as a role model. But there was nothing else at the time, really, in the 80s and the 90s, if you know. And now we see people like, we see all these big tech companies who are putting in billions to develop the metaverse, augmented reality, and artificial intelligence and everything. So it's a really a thrilling time, that and they're doing this for not for nefarious purposes. It could be capitalistic purposes, but it's not. They're not trying to destroy half the planet. So it's a very thrilling time that we're in, but it is very challenging as of recent, especially when you have a full-time job, to stay up to date.
Well, indeed, hence my question. And I think it's a very relevant question at a personal level, because in the end of the day, if the book is designed to help workers deal and protect and get ahead, it's how do you fit it in? And then how do you avoid, I'm really curious. So rabbit hole hell can be the next thing, because Aaron, I need to learn a little bit more about, oh, what did he mention? Augmented reality. What is that? Let me go figure it out. Next thing you know, you're reading vast tomes all about augmented reality, and meanwhile, on the sideline, virtual reality is taking off, or some new ChatGPT V5 is up and running. And so it is, I think, one of our true challenges is to how to orchestrate our learning in the VUCA world that we're living in.
Right. It's important for people to also relate, be able to relate what's going on with their work. There's no point to like go really, and I kind of make a point about this in the book. There's no point going really far out to learn coding and things like this if it's not re related to your work. So if your work, you have to use a lot of Excel, for instance, then it totally makes sense to learn how to master the shortcuts with a keyboard, rather than to learn Python or something. And then it probably makes more sense to learn how to use formulas, how to use pivot chart tables, and eventually how to use Visual Basic, the VBA coding, because this is really related to Excel, rather than trying to learn something really out there that is not related to your job. Maybe it makes more sense to learn Power BI if that's what your company has. If you have a business analytics tool, this makes more sense than learning other things.
Yeah, and you
So you really
very,
have to keep your feet to the ground,
yeah, and you very correctly point out how you should be linking this journey to things like what you're passionate about, what you're good at, and where there's a market. I mean, the ikigai type of approach, and that really speaks to getting to know who you are as an individual, and trying to figure out who you want to be, as you write, in the future, and then you can sort of orient your learning if. And this is a big old if. You have first a knowledge of who you want to be, and two, the discipline.
It's funny that you mentioned this, because actually I felt I probably didn't put enough emphasis on this, and this is really where you come from, because I know you're big on this about what is your own raison d'être, what is your own purpose and everything. So I do take a lot of notes that I take out from the textbooks of how a business is supposed to be run, because I believe an individual should do the same way. And a lot of the book is about transposing what businesses do, like, branding yourself, creating a compelling story, automating tasks that can be automated, going for more cognitive work, and all of these things which businesses do, and including doing a SWOT analysis and these very basic things. We need to do this ourselves, but we also need, just like a business, we need to know what are our values, What is our mission statement? What is our vision for the world? These are really important things that we're not taught about, that society just left us out. And it's very difficult to do this as a human being. It's even more difficult than for a company, because a company is usually founded with a purpose. Whereas, you know, you're brought to this world, your parents don't give birth to you thinking, okay, this person in 20 years, this is what he's going to do or something. And that's what I'm going to grow him up for. You know, no, that's not the way it works. So I don't feel like I put enough emphasis on this. I'm actually working on the French translation now and adding a few, like, you know, enhancements to this. So that'll probably be in the next edition.
Well, let me say, I feel for you, because I have translated two of my books into French as well. So I know exactly the journey that you're on, trying to make it more relevant for a Francophone market and such. And then, you know, things have happened since you wrote this first one, because that takes a whole lot of work, and new things have come up, and update for this and update for that. Bonne chance, mon cher. One of the stories that, so going a little bit coq à l'âne, as we say in French, from this to that, one of the stories that I really enjoyed was the salt story. Of there was a, you know, crisis of food, and people tried to get enough meat, and then the soldier goes and has a super astute idea. Tell us about that, because I loved your fleur de sel follow up.
That was just it was the idea of it was part of the, I was talking about the importance of social networking. So it was kind of a sub story within that, but it was the idea of also at the same time, the importance of what is finding what is scarce, what has value. So it's a bit the mix between two, but yeah, this was a story that took place during the Civil War, where there was some, I believe it was some looting happening around Atlantic City or something like this with Sherman's army.
The U.S. Civil War, to be precise.
The U.S. Civil War, yes, sorry.
Indeed.
And during the American Civil War, yeah, there was some looting, and the people, you know, they were living off the terrain. And so they picked up a lot of the soldiers. They found stockpiles of food, and they picked up, they stuffed as much meat as they could. One of the soldiers, instead of taking meat, he took salt. And the others didn't understand why he filled his bag with salt. But by doing this, he was able, throughout the following days and weeks, to trade his salt against the meat that the others had, because you need the salt in order to preserve the meat, and in order to have to make it taste better too. So by doing this, he was able to have more meat than any of the others had, and than he could have ever carried. So that was, yeah, his clever way of getting through, because he was the only one who had only stockpiled salt. And that was in terms of the rarity. There's a lot of cases like this. If you look well, like if you look today, a taxi driver to get from here to the airport in Shanghai is maybe 30 euros. Exactly. Well, a year and a few months ago during the lockdown, it was very difficult to get out of your home, let alone find a taxi, let alone get to the airport. So the very few drivers who had this license to be able to go out and take people around, they were charging at the time 10 times the price, because suddenly driving became a scarce thing.
Scarce activity. And then you have your example of the fleur de sel, which you bring as, I would call it, the French touch.
Right. That was the example when I go, and even actually enough, or when you go to a barbecue or something, people will usually bring a bottle of wine. But actually, being from France, I would be able to reach this area called La Boule, where we have some of the best salt in the world. And the top of the best salt is called fleur de sel, as you say. And a bag of this, when you go there, is probably like 30 euros. So it's the price of a, you know, average good bottle of wine. And I would rather bring a bag of this than a bottle of wine, because it's something that is more unique, more original, and it comes from a special place, and it brings, it lasts for a very, very long time, and it really makes the meat feel a lot better. So it's something that has a lot more value than just a bottle of wine amongst many that you will just end up drowning on the same evening and forget about. You know?
Indeed. Well, so a hat tip to my friends at Le Boule, Anne and Jean-Jacques. So hopefully they'll enjoy that particular idea. One of the things that really intrigued me, Ashley, about you in your book is the fact that you're based in Shanghai. For the West, China, Shanghai, it's quite opaque, obscure, difficult to understand. And I was just wondering to what extent your viewpoint in your mind has been fed by the long period of life that you've had in China, notwithstanding your full knowledge and Franco-Americanness.
What we see in China is acceleration is very visible here. There's less of a link to the past, and people are okay with change. They've witnessed a incredible change over the decades, so they're always going. They're always switching to something new, and they have very, you know this. For instance, in the luxury field, they have limited brand loyalty. They're always like switching and testing new things, and so they're always into this tech acceleration. And so you see the future kind of coming up here. It's like it's a country that is turned totally towards the future, whereas in Europe people are turned a bit more towards the past. And it's very exciting to see this. Although it's a bit changed now, as you know, the economic situation in the past year isn't that great. But until for the past 20 years that I've been here, it was really the place of, open to the future. So it also like was very had a predominant impact on writing the book, because you see this big race to automate very present here, partly for reasons of demographics, because as you know, there's a big threat of aging population here, which is like a big social time bomb, and it's a time bomb for companies.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We out.
How do you think that inverse pyramid of ages, or at least, changing pyramid, is impacting, influencing the way that the Chinese are approaching technologies? Do you see them getting into octogenarian AI healthcare? how does it inform and shape the way the Chinese are approaching this battle royale?
They're especially, what I see the most is that they want to, again, there's a race to automate work here for which you cannot find labor anymore. So I have the example recently with Schindler, the elevator company from Switzerland. In China, there's a bit of a weird law where you have to maintain elevators every 2 weeks. So every single elevator in every single building needs to have a maintenance guy come and check the elevator every 2 weeks. And this is a huge burden for elevator companies. So they're trying to upgrade the elevators with IoT devices and things like that to really facilitate maintenance and do preventive maintenance. And they're working together with the government to do this, because the government is very aware of this acute labor shortage in this type of job, so that they can transition and change the law so that they no longer have to have this very strict regulation anymore. So it's just an example, but we have like a huge issue coming up. As you see in the book today, China has 900 million workers. By 2050, there will be only 700 million workers forecasted. So that's 200 million workers less, which is just a huge amount. That's more than the entire workforce of the United States. So how do you compensate for this? Automation is one of the main directions that the country is marshaling forth in order to solve this issue.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is there, in this particular case with Schindler, there's the, or Lyft in general, is this collusion, or at least work with the government, because at the end of the day, or that speaks, in my opinion, more to the Chinese situation, and yet we do need to think about this idea of regulation, which seems to be a pretty spiny topic. How does one appraise regulation, and how is it different in your mind when you look at Europe, France, United States, and China?
Oh, each of the countries has a very different approach, but in terms of regulation, there is a lot that needs to be done. It's just looking at the issues posed in general by AI, augmented reality, when this comes out, in mass society, there's just so many ethical issues that are being raised, and so many areas where we need regulation to intervene or to provide a framework for companies to be able to work, and including in terms of protocols and harmonization of these protocols. So there's just so many areas that are needed. And for related to work, it could be more flexible methods of work. It could be more, regulation sometimes is very damaging to work when You have things like, even if it's with the good intentions, if you raise the minimum wage, it makes it more appealing for companies to seek other ways to get the work done using silicon, using, you know, artificial intelligence instead of using labor. So it's there can be some negative effects even when there's good intentions.
I know your book isn't intended for the government, but if you had for government a person related to regulation were listening, what advice would you be giving them in terms of like a framework for their work?
In terms of the future of work, or
yeah,
in
terms of regulating AI and the tech that's out there, because at the end of the day, you know, you and I at the beginning, we talked about how difficult it is to stay up to date, and we yet are at the coalface with a lot of this stuff. Someone in government was brought up at a very swank school, perhaps, but that doesn't make them equipped to understand how to deal, regulate, and inform people.
No, there's a lot. I mean, so as you said, this isn't a topic that I really am focused or have researched or consider myself an expert on, because there's a lot of there's really a lot of areas where there's a lot of ethical concerns being posed by AI. And then it's really unfortunate that a large part of the debate is turning around the prospects of artificial superintelligence, which is really something that we should keep for later, because we're nowhere near to getting there. So that's not something we need to worry about today. But unfortunately, a lot of the discussion is centered on that. But I believe the government should at least, that there should be really some sort of organization created, like a panel, government and with scientists, with data scientists, with businesses, and with, you know, a bit of all the stakeholders, even employees, you know, for that matter, and some citizens, like some sort of organization created, a little bit like you have with the ISO, something like this. But even if it's just at a state level, that could be a good start, because you can't, you know, you can't go dream too big at the beginning. But just at the state level, if you start to have this kind of corpus that can then think about the problem, tackle the issues, work on them one by one. And that's not just a temporary thing. It's really just a longstanding thing to remain informed. These people can then inform, you know, other decision makers within the government. They can help to define the regulations and the policies that are necessary and provide recommendations that are listened to. And I think I think there's organizational bodies like this for environment and for different areas. There needs to be one for new technologies also.
Yeah, to have these sort of poly-sectorial, poly-valent, or at least very different types of skill sets and attitudes and stakeholders, as you say. I mean, I had the experience in July of focusing on one topic, not for regulation, but in the same kind of vein, look at the big idea, which is how does one really look at, evaluate, measure empathy, and then think about it in a machine. And we had 24 people. We had a sociologist, anthropologist, psychotherapist, and all this melange of people. And yet it's very hard to galvanize all these opinions and come up with one regulation at the end of the day. You can't meet everybody's needs.
No, and there's no easy solution, because we're talking about a revamping of the existing capitalist model. A lot of the jobs that are necessary today are not jobs that are well-paying according to the capitalist model. It's jobs for healthcare, for instance, jobs for tendering for the elderly. These jobs are really not well-paid at all. And there's a big gap of labor here, but it's not jobs that people want to do. And there's no help from, there's insufficient help from the government on these jobs. So right now, the way that it's a bit too much free market. And I'm not saying we need to go towards a communistic society, but there needs to be something more equitable for people, and that's where we need more of a debate, and that's what a lot of the, you know, the futurist writers are advocating for. But so far it seems like it falls on deaf ears.
Well, I was wondering if you had, do you read fiction,
science fiction?
Yeah
sure.
Do you have any books that you feel are good science fiction or dystopian models that might help spark people's also interest and intrigue in this area?
Well, there's plenty. I mean, there's, you know, the Brave New World, the obviously 1984. I mean, these are they're not classics for, you know, there are any reasons. They remain very much alive today in terms of some of the things happening in there. It's actually quite scary. Then there's some more recent things. The one that Li Kaifu wrote with Chu Chenfan, 2042, 10 Visions of the Future, something like this, is very interesting also because it mixes a fictional short story with an analysis coming after. It's kind of like watching a Black Mirror only in a book. So it's quite interesting also. They focus on several different topics.
I like that. Well, we could put those in the show notes. The one I would add to the plate, and I think it's relevant as it only is 99 years old. Next year, it'll be 100 years old, is Zamyatin Zui, which is a powerful indicator of this idea of global happiness. We'll see how that all plays out. So in your book, you do lay out in the end, you bring it all to fruit, if you will, in a conclusion, talking about the how each individual needs to find their way through it. One of the things that I really enjoyed in that moment, especially considering it's a foreign concept and word, is this idea of, and I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly, Guangxi, or I suppose something like that, Guanxi.
Relations.
And so tell us about that, because I think that's a genuinely useful insight for us.
It's Guanxi is the Chinese word which loosely translates as the relations, the networks that you forge around you, that the people that you know. And I think it's something where we are very, it's still very rudimentary the way that we do this. If you think you're really well connected and everything, but if you look on any social media app, and this, for instance, is WeChat, whether it's WeChat or whether it's WhatsApp or whatever, I find I'm very startled that this is still just unidimensional. It's a linear listing of my contacts. There's nothing better. There's no two-dimensional, no three-dimensional view where I can see who knows who and how well do we know each other and who did favors to who and how. There's I can apply filters to see things. It's just really extremely limited. So we don't have any good tool for this yet, which is really, for me, it's surprising that none of the big tech companies come up with this because it's not that complicated to do. But yes, the idea is that the networks are very important for your career, for your work, and for your future later. You never know if when you reach 40 or 50 or 60, you decide like, okay, suddenly I want to open my own business or something. And then you're going to think, oh, well, I need to know a banker. I need contacts in this area, that area. And then you realize, wow, so I did know people like this, but I would never really was nice to them. I never really called them out or anything. I haven't kept touch with them. So now that's a bit of a pity, but by then it's too late. So you need to really look early on and build contacts. And if you read any books about, you know, how to get rich or how rich people live or something, these are already principles that they live by. And there's a lot of really good books written on this, like Never Eat Alone by superconnector Keith Ferrazzi, that are really brilliant and that explain this. And it's true that this is also an advantage that we have over artificial intelligence or what. It's the social networks that we can create and that we can build and that we can feed and helping people around us. It's also, you know, at a certain point you mentor others, and it's really a gift that you can give as a human being.
Well, I want to get back to Guangxi in a moment, but when we look at these social networks, I would say judgment is that they seem to do only the things which are useful for their business model, as opposed to what actually would be useful for us. You know, LinkedIn keeps on spamming people saying, connect with mentors. I get these ridiculous connection requests people have never met in my life. What kind of a relationship is that? Well, I don't know them. They don't know me, really. And it's just flat and superficial.
Right. I was referring to social networks in the physical world, not the digital social networks. Digital social networks is a different beast altogether. And I share your criticism. Personally, I used to ride this wave at the beginning when it came up because I thought it was really nice, especially because I lived in a lot of different places. It was really cool for me to reconnect with people that I hadn't seen in 20 years or in 30 years or family members I didn't know about and everything. But in the end, it really doesn't, I kind of lost interest in this, and I found myself wasting too much time on this, and I sort of cut this off, and I don't really have much. I'm not that present on these networks anymore. So yeah, you have to be very careful with these. It's not the worst thing that you have in terms of digital entertainment these days, but
sure,
you have to be very careful with that about how you spend your time, and you're really responsible for your time, and we only have it's our most precious luxury, so you have to be careful with that.
We agree. Well, can you just explain a little bit more from an etymological standpoint, at least the Chinese element of Guangxi? Because it's that which I thought, which is beautiful. What does it mean in your term?
So my Chinese got a bit rusty, but it's basically relates to the roots that connect people. And so it's... It sort of goes back to Confucianism, where the links between yourself and society matter a lot, because it's kind of the idea that you only exist as much as you're being observed, and that you're in society with other people. If you're just a hermit living alone in a forest who's never seen anyone, it's the same as if you didn't exist, really, you know. So it's all about the bonds that people create with each other, and how this works out. And I mentioned in there, that's probably what you're referring to also the Hindu philosophy, where there's basically four different paths that we're going to have in one's life. And these are not exclusive to one to the other, but one of the paths is going to be Kama, which is quite famous with Kama Sutra, but it's basically the pursuit of pleasures of the five senses. So it can be eating too, or drinking. Then you have Artha, which is more the pursuit of riches, you know, material wealth. And then you have this, the Dharma, which is finding your place within society. And this obviously relates in part to the caste system, but it's the idea that, okay, this is what you're best at, you know, this is where you can fulfill yourself by doing this. And this is something, of course, in our modern society, we believe you have to find this for yourself. It's not just because your parents were making shoes that you need to make shoes and so forth. But that's basically the idea of Dharma, is where you find your best place in society, in the cosmos, is the way that you can sort of attain self-realization. And then the fourth path is the moksha, which is the deliverance of, you know, going into nirvana and all this, which is normally the final step.
I was intrigued, and maybe it's a little off topic, but I think it's still relevant, is this notion of community. No man is an island. I like to say you are as strong as your network. And you also talk about religion. In the West, or maybe, I don't know how we want to characterize it, but in a lot of societies, religion is on the down. It feels that community is being restrained. It's like my own little micro community, my ecosystem, my bubble, if we will, in other terms. And I was wondering to what extent you are seeing the same type of phenomenon or not in China.
Oh, yes. And in terms of the, well, in terms of the fact that you have digital smartphones and things like this that tend to isolate us, yeah, this is a phenomenon that is much as alive in China as elsewhere. And unfortunately, I think Chinese are more advanced on this. They spend more time on their phones. They do more shopping. They do more mobile payments. And everywhere where they're on the street walking, they're always doing it, watching a movie on the phone or something. So it's really a problem here. And it's ostracizing people than it more than it is connecting them, I believe. At least in the physical sense of the term. But yes, at the end of the day, you are the average of the five people that you hang out the most with. And if you don't hang out with five people, but you spend your time on Facebook or on TikTok, then you're going to become, you know, you know how the algorithms work. You're going to feed you more of what you like to see. So you end up really drinking your own bathwater, and you're not going to get a really good objective view of the world with many different perspectives in order to be able to forge your own judgments. And this is something that is really worrying me.
There's a survey, I believe, is out of the U.S. that talks about the average number of friends that true friends that people have, and that number a few decades ago was five. Then maybe 20 years ago it was four, and the most recent version of it we're down to three, and it does seem to You know, we're just reducing ourselves. We're no longer exploring. And especially in a world where, like you and I are dealing with so many different technologies, we can't possibly stay up to date with everything. And so the only alternative is to have a network that can help you, like you mentioned, your WhatsApp group. So let's, just for the last piece, talking about the future. So individuals who are listening, who will also have children, what do we need to cultivate? And the general area, you got the skills with regard to, let's say, tech. But the other one is my humanity. And my observation is, to start with, that our humanity is already suffering, in that we're no longer looking to craft deep bonds with more people. Living in a community, there's a lot more narcissism out there. So let's use that as a background before we start saying about enhancing our humanity or the things that make us unique versus a machine. So talk us through what you think we need to be focusing on.
When it comes to bringing up our kids?
Well, starting with myself and my humanity, because this is what the book's aimed at. And I'm going to get to the kids right after that.
I think it's important. So yeah, one end is you master the tools that are relevant to your job. The other end is you remain efficient or good at everything there where the tools cannot be of help. So it's not just because you have really sophisticated tools that you don't need to read anymore or get information anymore. So you need to still know how to read and things like this. In order to preserve your humanity, you need to remain curious and open as to what's going on in the world. You need to get out and, get out of your comfort zone. It's just these tools make it very comfy for us to remain in our comfort zone. It makes it really easy. You can remain entertained on your bed without having to go anywhere anymore. It's just, whereas before you would have to go out. You'd have to go out if you wanted to get food, if you wanted, no, now everything can come to you very easily. So it's important to keep on to keep roots with things that ancestors before us were doing, that our grandparents were doing, the way that the simple ways of life that includes having to do some manual labor, it includes having to go out, it includes remaining informed and doing things that you didn't really necessarily think you would like, but you try it out, and then you realize, wow, there's actually some interesting things that come out from this, and by doing this, you kind of broaden your mind.
It your comments make me think of a book that really had a big impact on me. It was called Lost Connections, which was written by an English journalist called Johann Hari. And what was interesting about what he was proposing, first of all, he was tackling this topic of mental health, and which I think is relevant in this whole story somehow. Mm-hmm. And how what he proposed were these seven different ways of connecting with ourselves, our friends, with earth, animals, like you say, the crafts in your hands, the manualness. And it feels like we part of the solution, not just to mental health, but also having fulfillment, épanouissement, as we say, in work is reconnecting in general.
Yeah. The best if you can find a work that you like, it doesn't feel like work anymore, no matter how late you're at there. That's obviously the ideal. It is a bit of a luxury, though, so not everyone can always have that luxury at all times. But yes, reconnecting is important, and there's different ways. There's no one path to do. Like for personally, I spend maybe a disproportionate amount of time looking inwards at my dreams. Since I'm age 13, I would write my dreams every morning. I have like entire notebooks full of my dreams. And I obviously read a lot of books, Jung and Freud and Kant, about dreams. But and I use this also to interpret all the different possible meanings. And it's really interesting to do this. But that's just a personal way. For someone else, it might be they might find relaxation through painting or kintsugi or some other craft or some other exploration, you know. But it's maybe some people find it through video games too. But I think, each person will find their way out there.
I have a Danish friend of mine who wrote a few books, and he talks about the importance of maintaining your dreams. I'll put a show note into his book as well, because I think that's a valuable idea. One of the things that we talk about, I mean, really, and this is obviously something you and I can get into the weeds on, which is these elements that are not automatable, not machinable, let's say. And typically we'll talk about a certain set of things like creativity and ideation. Let's say random. I think random is an interesting idea. Chaos, maybe. Imagination. And another one that I think is really useful is neuroticism. One considered like one of the big five traits that we have. And it's hard to program being neurotic. It feels deeply human. If that's the case, what do you think with your two children who are under 10 years old, if I can recall, what kind of educational system should we be promoting? Should we be changing education? Or if, of course, that seems like a rather large task, maybe at home, what do we need to be doing? Should we just be banning all computers or focusing on how to do both? Where what kind of advice do you and thoughts do you have about that?
There's a big debate on the idea of banning all screens at home, whether this is better for the kids, whether it handicaps them, whether it helps them to prepare for growing up in society or not. So then this depends on the age too. So that's a huge area of debate that I haven't yet really settled on. But for now, I'm trying to at least let my daughter be aware of this. So I was kind of pointing out to her when we go out, just the two of us sometimes, when we go out for a walk or we sit down at a coffee shop or something, I point out to her, look at everyone on their phones, you know? And I try and really pay attention to never be on my phone when she's in, you know, if she's coming, I put my phone away, even if I'm working or what, I try not to be on the phone when she's there. And now she's the one telling me like, well, look at that, look, there's like every single of the eight people around us, they're all staring at their phones. That people over there, the couple over there, they're on their phone and their kid is getting really bored because he doesn't have a phone. And the others over there, they put a phone for their kid. And I tell like, yeah, so I'm trying to let her slowly understand. I'm telling you, you know, every time when we go outside and you're so happy to point at me and yell, look, there's the moon up in the sky during the daytime. None of these people see the moon. None of these people ever notice the moon anymore when they go out during the daytime. And I tell her, like, you know, if I gave you a phone, would you be able to control yourself? Would you still be able to see the moon, or would you lose that innocence? It's a tough topic, but yes. So for the education, we obviously all have a responsibility, and each person is in the end responsible for their own education. So the schools, obviously, there's some change that needs to come from there. Schools have been mostly in the past century, since for over a century now, since school has been mandatory. The idea was to teach people a basic set of skills and knowledge, but also to teach them to do repetitive things, to follow a standard operating procedure, basically. And now we sort of need to move away from that, because this is what computers are good at and what algorithms are good at, to follow this if this, then that, and loops and things like this. So we need to focus more on how you think and how you reason and how you ask questions and how you remain open curiosity and things like this. So it's a very different kind of education that is necessary in order to keep this kind of openness and to see things like this, not just trying to memorize dates and things like this. But it's important to be able to show these changes and to think about it and to get people involved, including children involved in this. And some of the things, even the schools, they don't do a good job. When I was a kid, I criticized my history professor. I said, well, history is a useless subject. Why do you need history? It doesn't help you for work. History is not relevant to work. And the history teacher said, yes, I know, but da, da, da. And so he acknowledged this. And if I was now thinking back about this, I was like, no, it's not true. History helps you to develop a general culture. When you're a manager, when you're a leader and you're having a after party drink with work or something, if you have like two workers that are both very diligent in their job, working hard and trying to get to the next level, one of them is unable to hold a decent conversation with the bosses and other stakeholders. And the other one has this great general knowledge, is able to ping pong ideas, and you know, sometimes then you have a golden nugget, and this is the person that you'll think, okay, wow, this could be like a future leader. This is someone that I look more fit for promoting. So if you take two workers that are just as good on all the skills and everything, the one who has the better general culture is someone that you think, okay, this one has a cultural breadth that elevates this person to go further. And it's someone that you can have talking around with bosses and everything at the coffee or at the bar in the evening. So it does make a difference. If you're just being the shy person and, you know, the bosses are there and you're afraid that, you know, you can't talk with them about anything because all you know is about, I don't know, soccer or PlayStation or something, then, you know, that's a pity.
Lightweight. Well, I deplore a lot of what's happening in schools with regard to history, where we no longer study history in its context. We apply modern day mores and views on history. That's things that have happened in the past, as opposed to understanding where we come from. I mean, you say general culture, actually just culture in general. This idea of history is an enormous part of our culture, and so is language. And all the and language, there is a broadcast recently that said that the idea of formal language will disappear in emails. The ones which said, "Dear Ashley" or "Dear Mr. Recanati," and end with "Yours sincerely." Out with that and in with "Hi" emoticon. Yikes. We have lots of work. Ashley, it's been great fun chatting with you. Thank you for doing what you're doing. And let's say, how can people go grab AI Battle Royale, which is in the image for the people in video? I'll put all the show notes. And how can people follow you, track you down, see your readings and writings and everything?
The book is available on Amazon and various websites. I mean, it's just Google AI Battle Royale. And
even in China?
In China, it's a bit difficult to get. I mean, you can get it in Taobao, but it's a bit difficult to find in China. That's part of the whole conundrum about publishing a book in English and then being in China. So we're in discussion for a Chinese translation. So that might happen one day and that will help. But right now, yeah, it's not the easiest place to get your hands on it, which makes it a bit difficult for me to go and do book signings and things like that.
Yeah, apparently.
and yeah, you can, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, so that's also a place where I can be found.
And of course on WeChat.
I'm on WeChat.
Naturally. All right, well, I'll put all those in the show notes. Ashley, many thanks for coming on. Good luck with everything, including that tension, which I continue to have with the children about whether it's focusing on their humanity or their tech skills for the future job.
Thank you, mentor. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Mentor Dialogue podcast. If you like the show or would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/mentordial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on mentordial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die.
like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
Questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.